Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading The Atlantic Magazine. Beginning today with a piece from the April issue, The Unbearable Lightness of Signalgate. Nearly a year after a national security scandal erupted on my iPhone, no one in the Trump administration has faced consequences. By Jeffrey Goldberg. The Uniform Code of Military Justice serves as the criminal justice framework for America's armed forces. It covers offenses recognized by civilian law, as well as crimes and infractions unique to the military, from insubordination to cowardly conduct. The code contains 158 articles. The manual for courts-martial itself runs nearly 1,000 pages. It is an obvious truth that discipline, morale, and order can be maintained in military formations only if everyone, from four-star generals to the youngest boot privates, is held equally accountable for their actions. A cursory review of recent courts-martial suggests that the enforcers of military discipline don't miss much. In December, a Marine private first class was convicted of contempt or disrespect towards a non-commissioned or petty officer, and disrespect towards a superior commissioned officer in command. The private was held in confinement for 5 days and was reduced in rank. In September, an Air Force lieutenant was convicted of engaging in conduct unbecoming an officer after drinking on duty and cursing superior officers. He was sentenced to 30 days of confinement and received a presumably career-ending reprimand. In November, a senior airman, a medical specialist, was found guilty of failing to safeguard protected health information from unauthorized disclosure. She was sentenced to 1 month of confinement and received a temporary pay reduction and a reprimand. Also in September, an Army specialist was convicted of disrespecting a superior by interrupting her when she was speaking and then walking away, among other charges. A military judge reduced the specialist's rank and prevented her from leaving her military facility for 14 days. Many soldiers are punished for infractions related to the handling of their weapons. The unfortunate Louisiana National Guardsman who recently left his rifle in the bathroom of a hotel bar could face a court-martial. And members of the armed forces are also punished for mishandling information. The military is necessarily unforgiving of those who violate operational security. Loose lips sink ships, in the age-old shorthand. That is why seemingly quotidian bits of information, the dates and times that units are moving from one base to another, for instance, are held so closely. According to the UCMJ's Article 92, the punishments for the release of unauthorized information vary, but could include 2 years imprisonment. A unit commander, Operation Security Guidance states, must protect from unauthorized disclosure any sensitive or critical information to which they have personal access. In October of last year, a retired Army colonel, Kevin Charles Luke, who was at the time a civilian Department of Defense employee, was found guilty of sending a photo of a classified email to a woman he'd met online. The email contained information about an upcoming military operation. In early February, Luke was sentenced to 2 years in prison for his crime. It has been almost a year since the national security scandal that came to be known inevitably as Signalgate erupted on my iPhone. And I've been thinking through its consequences. Michael Waltz, the official who invited me into a Signal chat group, whose members included most of America's national security leadership, was removed as the president's national security advisor. But he soon received what is, to my mind at least, a promotion, and is now serving as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The Signal Foundation, the nonprofit organization that owns the messaging app, saw a dramatic increase in usage following the scandal. The Atlantic itself saw an unparalleled burst of subscription growth, and I personally managed to avoid prison and extract a brand new iPhone from my employer. President Trump suffered no negative consequences from Signalgate. In fact, he found it professionally riveting, carefully studying the way in which the Atlantic temporarily dominated the news cycle. He also suggested to me in an Oval Office meeting that took place as the scandal was subsiding that he should receive more credit for the Atlantic's success than I have granted him. As for Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, who shared what were quite obviously military secrets in a discussion held on a privately run messaging app that he didn't even know included a journalist, well, more on him later. Allow me to recount, as efficiently as possible, the sequence of implausible events here. On March 11 of last year, I was invited to connect on Signal by a user purporting to be Waltz. Soon after, I was invited to a chat called the Houthi PC Small Group. PC refers to Principals Committee, which included people identified as Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Hegseth, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence. I am suspicious by profession, and so I assumed that this was an entrapment scheme, or a foreign intelligence service operation, or a simulation beyond easy comprehension. But I know Waltz, please keep this fact in mind, and I have reported on national security matters for decades, so the invitation wasn't entirely outlandish. A reasonable guess is that my telephone number can be found, or could be found before Signalgate, in the contact lists of 7 or 8 members of the 18-person small group. The chat itself was highly realistic and fascinating. I watched as a substantive debate was held over whether the U.S. should immediately launch strikes against Houthi terrorist targets in Yemen. The vice president, quasi-isolationist in outlook, argued against such strikes, noting that Europe, not his favorite continent, would benefit disproportionately. A little while later, the chat participant identified as Hegseth wrote, "Waiting a few weeks or a month does not fundamentally change the calculus." Though he added, "We are prepared to execute, and if I had final go or no-go vote, I believe we should." The colloquy came to a sudden end when the user SM, whom I took to be the Trump confidant Stephen Miller, wrote, "As I heard it, the president was clear. Green light, but we soon make clear to Egypt and Europe what we expect in return." That was that. Hegseth wrote, "Agree." And the dissident vice president said nothing. And then came the day of the Yemen strikes. At 11:44 a.m. on Saturday, March 15, I was at a supermarket, a Safeway in the Chevy Chase neighborhood of Washington, D.C., when the following alert came in over Signal from Hegseth, "Team update." What followed was information that, had it been seen by an enemy of the United States, could have been used to kill American military and intelligence personnel. Hegseth promised that Yemen would be attacked within 2 hours. I've seen strange things in my career, but nothing quite like this. I stayed in my car in the Safeway parking lot and waited. I took screenshots of the chat and searched X and other platforms for news of U.S. military activity. Hegseth had said in the chat that the first detonations would be felt at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Time. At approximately 1:55 p.m., credible news reports started appearing about an attack. In the chat, congratulations began to pour in. Waltz posted 3 emoji, a fist, an American flag, and fire. Steve Witkoff, Trump's all-purpose, in-over-his-head global conflict negotiator, responded with 5 emoji, 2 praying hands, a flexed bicep, and 2 American flags. Later, the Houthi-run Yemeni health ministry reported that at least 53 people had been killed in the attack. The number has not been confirmed independently. The Houthis are despicable terrorists, and in my opinion should be fought and defeated, but there was still something disturbing about the proliferation of emoji. Proof that the chat was authentic forced me, and a growing number of advisors sworn to secrecy, to make a choice. I was interested in exposing a security breach at the highest reaches of government. I was less interested in being accused of violating the Espionage Act. I would thus exit the chat later that same day. The signal group would be alerted that I had left, so timing was important. That evening was the annual dinner of the Gridiron Club, at which Washington journalists host senior administration officials and members of Congress and make mainly mild fun of them from the stage. I heard that Waltz might be attending. I didn't want the FBI raiding the dinner to seize my phone, so I waited until the end of the dinner to leave the chat. I spent the next hours awaiting recognition by the federal government that I was an apostate member of the Huthu PC small group. But nothing. As a reporter, I was relieved. As a citizen, I was appalled by the violation of the first commandment of digital hygiene, thou shalt know who is in thy group chat. The next week rushed by as we prepared the story for publication. I decided not to include some of the key operational details shared by Hegseth, Waltz, and Ratcliffe, the CIA director. I wanted to expose their incompetence without releasing information that could hurt American troops. Early on Monday, March 24, I wrote to Waltz and Hegseth on Signal, of course, and then others by email, asking for confirmation and comment. I would learn that my requests set off a scramble in the White House. The National Security Council called an emergency meeting in the Situation Room, where the mood, as participants later described it to me, was one of incredulousness and anger. According to people who participated in the meeting, Alex Wong, who was then the principal deputy national security advisor, briefed officials, but he didn't have much information. The White House counsel, David Warrington, asked slowly and repeatedly, "How did this happen?" To their credit, White House officials quickly responded to me and confirmed the authenticity of the chat, and we published our story. These officials publicly argued that nothing secret or sensitive had been disclosed in the chat, which was nonsense, though their argument was helped by my decision to keep actual operational details out of the story. It was my word against theirs. There were two main worries in the White House that morning. The first, who would tell the president? It is my understanding that Susie Wiles, the White House chief of staff, instructed Waltz to tell Trump. Wiles, we would later learn, disliked Waltz, who treated her poorly. The second worry was that Hegseth, who was then flying to Hawaii aboard the Pentagon's doomsday plane, would be unable to muster a mature reaction to the story. Over the course of the day, officials spoke with him and texted him repeatedly while he was in the air, pleading with him to respond to questions by saying only that no classified information had been disclosed. Temperament is destiny, and Hegseth responded frantically and defensively. "You're talking about a deceitful and highly discredited so-called journalist who's made a profession of peddling hoaxes time and time again," he told reporters when he landed. He was referring to my reporting in 2020 and 2024 that Trump had made various contemptible comments about American troops, including that soldiers who fell in war were suckers and losers, and that Trump had also said, "I need the kind of generals that Hitler had." Multiple sources confirm that Trump had made these comments, including John Kelly, a former White House chief of staff and a retired Marine general. Waltz also responded in a juvenile manner, telling Fox News the next day that I am the bottom scum of journalists, and I know him in the sense that he hates the president, but I don't text him. He wasn't on my phone, and we're going to figure out how this happened. Waltz went on to say, "Of course I didn't see this loser in the group." I believe this is what is known as projection. And he made a comment that provided material for a week's worth of late-night comedy. In explaining how I may have been added to the chat, he said, "Well, if you have somebody else's contact, then somehow it gets sucked in. It gets sucked in." I recently learned that Wiles ordered Waltz to turn his phone over to Elon Musk, at the time a kind of one-man genius bar for White House officials, who reported back to Wiles that my phone number did not get sucked in to Waltz's phone. Waltz also denied ever having met me, which is not true. The ad hominem campaign by Waltz, Hegseth, Gabbard, the CIA, and White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, combined with the assertion that no classified information had been included in the chat, presented me with a dilemma. I knew, of course, that the information I'd seen on my phone would ordinarily be judged top secret by the military, and I knew that the White House lies were meant to undercut the credibility of this magazine. I simply could not understand why the administration was goading me into releasing the full message chain, which would show that I was correct in stating that the information was highly secret. We devised a plan. My colleague Shane Harris, who covers the intelligence community, and I would speak with leaders of the relevant government agencies and ask them if they objected to the publication of the rest of the messages. This written statement from Leavitt illustrates the sophistication of the administration's response. As we have repeatedly stated, there was no classified information transmitted in the group chat, she wrote. However, as the CIA director and national security advisor have both expressed today, that does not mean we encourage the release of the conversation. This was intended to be an internal and private deliberation amongst high-level senior staff, and sensitive information was discussed. So for those reasons, yes, we object to the release. We published a follow-up story and included the operational messages from Hegseth and Waltz. Here is the key text from Hegseth. Time now, 11:44 ET. Weather is favorable. Just confirmed with CENTCOM, we are a go for mission launch. CENTCOM, or Central Command, is the military's combatant command for the Middle East. He continued, 12:15 ET, F-18's launch, first strike package. 13:45, trigger-based F-18 first strike window starts. Target terrorist is at his known location, so should be on time. Also, strike drones launch, MQ-9s. 14:10, more F-18s launch, second strike package. 14:15, strike drones on target. This is when the first bombs will definitely drop, pending earlier trigger-based targets. 15:36, F-18 second strike starts. Also, first sea-based Tomahawks launched. More to follow per timeline. We are currently clean on OPSEC. Godspeed to our warriors. It would have been more accurate to have written, we are currently clean on OPSEC, except that I'm sending this information to the editor of The Atlantic. To honestly believe that this information was not secret would require Hegseth to achieve Olympian levels of self-deception. As all of this was happening, I was receiving messages from various military officials expressing disdain and anger that Hegseth refused to take responsibility. None of them went public with their outrage, however. Other people did, including a modest number of Republicans. Senator Roger Wicker, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, told reporters, "The information as published recently appears to me to be of such a sensitive nature that, based on my knowledge, I would have wanted it classified." Wicker and his Democratic counterpart, Senator Jack Reed, asked for a Pentagon investigation. I doubted that this would occur because the administration was dismantling the Inspector General system across the federal government. But an investigation was soon said to be underway. Only two administration figures did not seem especially alarmed or defensive during the controversy. The first was the vice president, who, we would later learn, made one final joking addition to the Houthi PC small group chain late on the night after my first story appeared. "This chat's kind of dead," he wrote. "Anything going on?" The other was the president himself. "I was worried that the signal story would complicate already complicated efforts by my colleagues Ashley Parker and Michael Scherer to get an interview with Trump. But instead, and this was somewhat predictable to those of us who have paid close attention to Trump over the years, he not only granted them an interview, but invited me to participate. He could not resist the temptation to troll us along the way, however. 3 hours before our scheduled visit to the Oval Office, he posted the following message on Truth Social. Later today, I will be meeting with, of all people, Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, and the person responsible for many fictional stories about me, including the made-up hoax on Suckers and Losers and Signalgate, something he was somewhat more successful with. Jeffrey is bringing with him Michael Scherer and Ashley Parker, not exactly pro-Trump writers either, to put it mildly. The story they are writing, they have told my representatives, will be entitled The Most Consequential President of This Century. I am doing this interview out of curiosity and as a competition with myself, just to see if it's possible for The Atlantic to be truthful. Are they capable of writing a fair story on Trump? The way I look at it, what can be so bad? I won. When we entered the Oval Office, Trump said, "This will be very, very interesting. You think Biden would do this? I don't think so." He was correct. "Thanks for announcing the interview on Truth Social," I said. "I wanted to put a little extra pressure on you," he said, "but at the same time, you'll sell about 5 times more magazines." I asked him in the course of the interview what he meant by, "I will be meeting with, of all people, Jeffrey Goldberg." "Oh, you like that? I had to do that," he said. "I had to explain to people. That's my way of explaining to people that you're up here, because most people would say, 'Why are you doing that?' I'm doing that because there is a certain respect." "Are you saying that Signalgate was real?" I asked. "Yeah, it was real. And I was going to put in something else, but I didn't have enough time." This led me to ask, out of sheer curiosity, "How long does it take you to write these?" "Not long," he answered. "I go quickly as hell. You'd be amazed. You'd be impressed. And I like doing them myself. Sometimes I dictate them out, but I like doing them myself. What I'm saying is that it became a big story. You were successful, and it became a big story." Me: "But you're not saying that it was successful in the sense that it exposed an operation security problem that you have to fix?" Trump: "No, what I'm saying is it was successful in that you got it out very much to the public. You were able to get something out. It became a very big story." I then asked him directly if there were any other possible lessons to be learned from the Signal breach. The president answered, "I think we learned maybe don't use Signal, okay?" Months went by. We heard, again and again, that the Defense Department's Inspector General would investigate, but nothing came of it. Finally, in December, the report was released. It found what had seemed obvious from the outset, that Hegseth's use of Signal to discuss bombing Yemen could have exposed U.S. tactics and endangered troops. The secretary sent information identifying the quantity and strike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory over an unapproved, unsecure network approximately 2 to 4 hours before the execution of those strikes. The report reads, "If this information had fallen into the hands of U.S. adversaries, Houthi forces might have been able to counter U.S. forces or reposition personnel and assets to avoid planned U.S. strikes. Even though these events did not ultimately occur, the secretary's actions created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S. pilots." The report concluded, however, that because the Secretary of Defense possesses original classification authority, meaning he has the power to declassify secrets at will, he wasn't technically in violation of any rules governing secrecy, only rules banning the use of private messaging apps for official Pentagon business. Hegseth claimed that the report cleared him of all wrongdoing. "No classified information," he posted on social media. "Total exoneration. Case closed. Houthis bombed into submission. Thank you for your attention to this IG report." He had not always been so forgiving when it came to matters of operational security. In 2016, at the height of the furor concerning Hillary Clinton's email server, Hegseth, then a Fox News host, said, "How damaging is it to your ability to recruit or build allies with others when they are worried about our leaders maybe exposing them because of their gross negligence or their recklessness in handling information?" The U.S. is now engaged in another bombing campaign, larger and more sustained than the strikes on the Houthis. Every day, hundreds of aviators are ordered into the airspace above Iran. Their lives depend on the operational security that the military's culture of accountability is designed to safeguard. The Department of Defense employs nearly 3 million people, uniformed and civilian. All are subject to rules and regulations governing many aspects of their behavior. Any one of them would have faced serious consequences for announcing, on an insecure messaging app, that the U.S. was about to send its pilots over enemy territory. All except one. Next, also from the April issue, leaving the United States behind. The Cruz family spent years building a life in New York. Then the risks of staying became too great. By Caitlin Dickerson. The Cruz family was exhausted. It was 2 days before Christmas, 2024, and Rachel was coughing from bronchitis, her body once again crashing into the holiday break as she finished her 17th year teaching public high school in New York City. Irvy, her husband, was sleeping after his day shift at an upscale bistro on the Upper West Side, which had followed an overnight shift at a Latin dance club farther uptown in Inwood. Between the two jobs, he dropped their daughters, Sarah, 12, and Anna, 10, at their schools for gifted students, then rushed home to the Bronx to cook and do laundry. For years, Rachel and Irvy had been hustling to make this routine work, hoping that American immigration policy would evolve and allow Irvy, who had spent half his life in the United States, to become a citizen. Raising two children in New York City was expensive. Each day felt like a marathon they didn't think they could finish. But the girls were thriving, and Rachel and Irvy were beloved at work. Every few years, they met with lawyers who urged them to hang on, so they did. I met the Cruz family in late 2016, when Donald Trump's election and his contempt for immigrants first made them think of moving to Irvy's hometown in rural southern Mexico. But their daughters were just 2 and 4 then, and uprooting them was daunting. 4 years later, Joe Biden's win made the Trump years seem like an aberration, and Rachel and Irvy thought, once again, that a solution to their problem was within reach. Then came 2024, when 77.3 million Americans voted for Trump. His campaign signs had called for mass deportation now. To the Cruises, the message was clear. Irvy should give up and go home. The family had never been apart for long. The four of them linked arms or held hands when they walked down the street together without seeming to notice they were doing it. Separation was not an option. So they would go, all of them. "We no longer have the faith that things will always be better here in the United States," Rachel told me that night in December, sitting at their dining table, cupping a Zabar's mug full of tea. Drained from work, Irvy shuffled down the stairs in sweatpants. He had dark bags under his eyes, but greeted me with his squinty smile. He sat down and said he was excited to live freely for the first time in his adult life. He was also scared. The only story he'd known about his family, that they were proud New Yorkers, was about to end. Sarah, who had been standing behind him, playing with his salt-and-pepper hair, ran into the kitchen to cry. Rachel hurried after her. "What do you want?" Rachel asked softly. "Do you want to give Papa a hug?" "No, I just want to go to my room," Sarah said. "I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to be here." "Well, if we get it out now, maybe it'll make you feel better later," Rachel told her, unsure if that was true. Their tentative plan was to sell the house and move in with Irvy's parents, 2,100 miles away. Irvy would go first, so he'd be out of the country before Trump took office. Rachel and the girls would join him 7 months later, in August 2025, after finishing the school year and summer camp. They didn't know what they'd do for income in Mexico, or where the girls, who knew only a little Spanish, would go to school. Friends thought they were overreacting. Some were upset. After all, New York was a sanctuary city, and Irvy was married to an American citizen. Rachel and Irvy found these reactions maddening. They saw their American friends as stubbornly naive about the system they had been battling for decades, and their undocumented friends as deluded for clinging to hope instead of reason. Rachel's mother, Susan McCormick, had heaved and sobbed when she learned that the granddaughters she was helping to raise would be leaving New York. She and Rachel's father, Doug, were furious with the country for putting them in this situation. Their daughter was one of nearly 4.2 million American citizens and permanent residents in the United States with an undocumented spouse, and Sarah and Anna were among 6.3 million children with an undocumented parent. How many were also choosing family over country? And what was the United States losing in the process? By Christmas 2024, the McCormicks were trying to be stoic, to give Rachel and Irvy strength, and to show the girls that everything was going to be okay. Doug had become a genealogy nerd in retirement and was reminding himself that their ancestors had made a move like this every few centuries. Irish farmers running from famine, Germans displaced by war, and Russian and Ukrainian Jews escaping pogroms. He even found ancestors aboard the Mayflower. But all of these prior generations had found refuge here. After 400 years in this country, Doug told me, suddenly America doesn't want my children and grandchildren. Rachel, Irvy, and their daughters would be the first in their family to run from, rather than to, the United States. On September 11, 2001, Irvy was 19 years old and had recently arrived in upstate New York. He was working on a construction crew remodeling a Chinese restaurant when the Spanish music on the radio was interrupted by grave English he didn't understand. Terrorists had flown jets into the World Trade Center. George W. Bush's administration would soon abandon negotiations to grant legal status to undocumented Mexicans and instead create the Department of Homeland Security with a mission to deport them. But on September 12, Irvy's employer still wanted him to come to work as if nothing had happened. It was the kind of mixed message that would characterize his life in the United States. After a few more years of construction work, he felt homesick and returned to Mexico. But as soon as he touched down there, he felt he'd made a mistake. He had grown up in a one-room house without running water, dreaming of riding a motorcycle, a luxury that he could never afford if he stayed. He started making plans to go back to New York right away. Irvy's parents, Lulu and Martin, were leery of his decision. Both were the children of peasant farmers and had grown up in homes made of adobe and sticks. But they never thought of joining the more than 8 million Mexicans who'd moved north, starting with their parents' generation and the U.S. government's Bracero program for temporary workers. American farmers got hooked on cheap labor and, after the program ended in 1964, continued to recruit Mexican workers who now had to cross the border illegally. Lulu, a street vendor, was afraid that discouraging Irvy would backfire. Martin, a bus driver on Mexico's dusty rural highways, couldn't hold back. "That country will eat you," he said of the United States. "Of course, here it's more work and less money, but you get used to it." When Irvy told them he was going back, his parents knew they might never see him again. Martin thought to himself, "I don't have a son anymore." With his 16-year-old cousin, Irvy tried to sneak back across the border somewhere in Arizona. They got lost in the desert, and Border Patrol agents found them. Irvy's cousin started crying, and one of the agents gave them water, peanuts, and cookies. "Don't worry, you're safe now," the agent said in Spanish. "Tomorrow you can try again, and maybe you'll make it." After a few attempts, they were successful. Back in upstate New York, Irvy returned to working in construction. He was determined to learn English, so he immersed himself in American music and television, especially Chappelle's Show. Around that time, Rachel, who grew up in a wealthy suburb of Philadelphia, graduated from Vassar. She had studied abroad in Mexico and taken a class with the geographer Joseph Nevins, who gave lectures about the American government's complicity in a system that exploits immigrants for their labor but denies them the dignity of legal residency. She and Irvy met on a sunny afternoon in 2006 while they were watching an outdoor soccer game in Poughkeepsie. She was hobbling around on crutches because of a sprained ankle, and he jumped up to help her. Rachel was swept away by Irvy's sweetness and exuberance. Irvy loved Rachel's intelligence and empathy. They talked about everything, their different upbringings, their jobs, their roommate drama. Soon he was visiting her on the weekends in Philadelphia, where she had gotten a job. On one trip, a police officer stopped him, saw that he was undocumented, and let him off with a warning. To avoid the risk of driving for visits, Irvy moved in. Around 2009, they went to see the first of many lawyers, who said that Irvy wasn't eligible to apply for legal status, even if he married Rachel, because he had gone back and forth across the border after living for more than a year in the United States. The only workaround was for him to spend 10 years in Mexico and then apply for a waiver. But a Democratic Congress, with Barack Obama in the White House, appeared to be on the precipice of passing immigration reform. Eventually, Rachel got a teaching job in New York, and they found an apartment in Harlem. Irvy started bussing tables at the bistro on the Upper West Side, while Rachel taught overcrowded classrooms of low-income students. Despite the pressure and burnout, she felt like she was offering kids a chance at the American dream. No matter where you come from, she believed, if you land in a public school and if you get a teacher like me, you can make it. On their third anniversary, Irvy proposed in a rowboat in Central Park. Sarah was born in 2012, Anna in 2014. Irvy was their full-time caretaker, toting them by subway to museums, the aquarium, the zoo, and story time at the public libraries. On weekends, he squeezed in 5 shifts as a busboy. He and Rachel made enough money to cover the essentials, and Rachel's parents helped with childcare, but they went years without paying for a haircut or buying new clothes. They sometimes fought when they were tired and felt like they hadn't seen each other in weeks, or when Irvy's spontaneity clashed with Rachel's need for order. But they could never stare each other down for long without cracking a smile. Irvy's unresolved immigration status trailed them, usually from a distance. ICE agents once entered their apartment building looking for a neighbor. Rachel stood guard at the peephole while Irvy hid in the bedroom. A few years later, Irvy borrowed his in-laws' car to take the girls to Coney Island. As they approached the park, he spotted a police checkpoint at the entrance. He pulled over and had a panic attack, then tried to play it off by telling the girls that the car was breaking down. Rachel and Irvy talked about what to do if ICE ever tried to arrest him while she was at work. Irvy would have to persuade the officers to wait long enough for Susan and Doug to pick up the girls. "You have to fight to make sure that our kids are safe," Rachel told him. For years, Congress debated changes to the immigration system, including ones that would have helped Irvy. When Sarah was old enough, she joined Rachel at protests with a sign that said, "Don't report my dad." As part of a campaign called Dream Across America, Rachel rode a bus to Washington, D.C., where members of Congress admitted to activists that they hadn't known that so many mixed-status families were in limbo. Rachel was stunned by Trump's first election, but Irvy had expected it. Up to this point, Sarah and Anna had only a vague understanding that their father was different from them, but they began to realize that he was in danger. Anna lost interest in playing with other children and asked her parents why the president hated her. She had nightmares and panic attacks and had to see a therapist. Irvy distracted her and Sarah with bedtime stories about Eddie Spaghetti, a caricature of himself, who fought battles against dragons and monsters, inspired by rude customers at his restaurant. As they did their best to block out national politics, their community embraced them. Rachel's students nominated her for a Big Apple Award, which recognizes the best teachers in the city, and she became the head of the department at her school that teaches English as a new language. Anna and Sarah became fixtures in their school plays and joined a children's choir that rehearsed at Riverside Church. At the bistro, Irvy was promoted to server and then manager. He took night shifts at the club in Inwood and began bringing home more money than Rachel, enough to buy the motorcycle he had dreamed of. They borrowed against Rachel's retirement savings for a down payment on a bright blue townhouse in the Bronx's Little Italy. The house was far from a subway stop, but had a spacious front porch that looked out onto a maple tree. The plumbing didn't work, and some rooms had no windows. Irvy paid his construction worker friends to help him fix it up. The family turned hiding their home's flaws into a giant art project, creating a mural out of postcards to cover up cracked walls and ornamenting the crooked old stairs with starburst wallpaper. Their American dream may have been spackled together with glue and construction paper, but it held. Rachel was standing in the front yard with a rake in her hand when their next-door neighbor, Cookie, ran out and announced that the 2020 election had been called for Joe Biden. Rachel felt something new, optimism. She and Irvy daydreamed about finishing the basement and redoing the kitchen. They started to believe they would grow old together there. During the summer of 2024, Biden announced a program, Keeping Families Together, that would finally allow people like Irvy to become citizens through their American spouse. Rachel holed up in their home office one Sunday with the application, attaching hundreds of documents that illustrated the life they had built together. She paid the government's $580 fee and clicked Submit. "It looks like Irvy might finally be getting legal protection," she texted me at the time. The next day, a federal judge put the program on hold after 16 Republican-led states sued. A few months later, Trump was reelected and the court terminated the program. Because of the application that Rachel had filed for Irvy, the incoming administration knew exactly who and where he was. In January 2025, after the holiday break, Rachel stayed up late watching TV interviews with survivors of the Los Angeles wildfires. She found comfort in hearing people say that even though their home was gone, they still had their family, and that's all that mattered. The girls picked 10 family activities to do before Irvy left the United States. Sarah wanted to go ice skating in Central Park. Anna requested a day at the American Dream Mall in New Jersey, which has a ski slope and a water park. They found discount tickets for Hairspray, Gypsy, and Annie. On Irvy's last day in New York, January 13, 2025, the whole family piled into the car for school drop-offs. Trump was planning to end a policy that made schools off-limits for immigration raids, so Rachel was carrying a trifold poster explaining what to do in an encounter with ICE. Irvy made a final trip to a Bronx bodega that served as a hangout for Mexican immigrants. He would go there when he felt homesick or when he was tired of speaking English. His friends tried again to talk him out of leaving. "Save more money first," they said, "or talk to a lawyer," as if Irvy hadn't been talking to lawyers for years. He left angry, but arrived home sad, knowing he might never see those friends again. He tucked the girls in that night and waited for Doug, Rachel's father, to arrive. Around 3 a.m., the two men, along with Mango the cat, climbed into an SUV that Irvy had bought on Facebook Marketplace and then crammed with their belongings. The three-day drive was smooth until they arrived at a gas station in South Texas that was swarming with Border Patrol agents. Irvy started panicking, and his face went gray. They stopped briefly at a family friend's house where they had planned to stay the night, but Irvy's nervous system was telling him to get out of the country now. By Inauguration Day, he was in his hometown of San Lorenzo Cacoretepec. His parents had spent 20 years scraping together money to rebuild their house out of concrete and add a second structure, which meant there was now room for Irvy, his sister, and their families. Irvy rose in the dark each morning and drove along a rocky dirt road to a small plot of land that his mother had inherited. There were no blaring car horns or subway trains roaring underground, just birdsong and rustling leaves. Irvy was enchanted and unnerved by Oaxaca's clear blue skies, unmarred by skyscrapers. He spent hours hunched over outside each day, digging in his family's land, pruning and picking, and breaking a sweat as soon as the sun came up. Along with relatives, he planted tomatoes, peppers, and onions, and sold them at outdoor markets. He barely broke even. His father had been right. In Mexico, you work more for less, and Irvy was struggling to adapt. He had been able to get anywhere in New York City without a map, but in Oaxaca, he felt lost. "I have to start over again," he told me. "It's like I wasted all that time in New York. Now that I'm here, everything I learned doesn't apply." He could not stand to watch the videos flooding his phone of armed ICE agents smashing car windows and wrestling fathers to the ground while their crying children watched from the back seat. It didn't help that Irvy's relatives worried that Rachel and the girls might never join him. They couldn't believe that U.S. citizens would trade the privileges of their home country just to be with Irvy. A cousin told him, "You're going to have to find a new wife." Rachel never thought of abandoning Irvy, not since the rowboat in Central Park. But she often felt guilty that he had to bear the psychological burden of their relationship. Now she thought it was her turn to sacrifice to keep the family together. Once school let out for the summer, and as ICE agents stormed immigration courthouses downtown, Rachel and the girls took apart their New York lives. The postcards and pictures came down, revealing the cracked walls underneath. Rachel became engrossed in Facebook videos of other moms who were documenting their family's self-deportation process and describing their relief to be out of the United States. Sarah had a final sleepover with friends. Two of them took her phone into a closet to record a message for her to listen to in Mexico. "You're an amazing friend," they said. "We're going to miss you so much." Rachel bought a trailer for the last of their belongings. Her coworkers threw her a surprise party. She found a private school in Oaxaca for the girls and secured a job for herself at an annual salary of $10,700, not nearly enough to live on, even in rural Mexico, and a pittance compared to her $120,000 salary in New York. They had accepted an offer on their house in the spring, but the deal still hadn't closed by July. Rachel couldn't afford the bills without Irvy's income, and her debts were mounting. She told the girls they were leaving August 1, with or without the house money. Rachel's father still couldn't believe it had come to this. "I'm heartbroken because I believe in this country in an almost religious way," Doug told me. "But as a country," he said, "we effed up." Rachel and the girls, plus Coleslaw the cat and Pinto the dog, had planned to stop at tourist attractions to say goodbye to the United States. But Rachel was so frustrated and anxious by the time they left that they stopped only to sleep. She sped to the border, her adrenaline pumping. Irvy flew to northern Mexico to finish the two-day drive with them. Rachel spent the first night at his parents' house wide awake and in tears. She told Irvy she felt like she couldn't breathe. They reminded themselves that if Oaxaca didn't work out, they could try Mexico City, or they could apply for visas to move to Spain or Canada. As Doug had told them, "The whole world is open to you now, except your home country." Anna, now 11, put up a few Broadway posters in her new bedroom. Sarah, now 13, hung birthday cards from friends in New York. They stuck their favorite New Yorker covers on the walls. When I arrived to visit them in early November, 3 months into their reunion, Irvy was still going to the farm before sunrise, and Rachel and the girls would leave home at 6 a.m. for the bumpy ride to school, which involved driving through a creek to reach a paved road. Anna said the hardest part about the move was leaving her New York friends, because it had taken her many years to make them. She made one friend at her new school whose family had moved from Canada that year. They sat together at lunch, talking about what it was like to start over somewhere new. Meanwhile, Sarah sauntered across campus in a swarm of girls who delighted in practicing their English skills on her. Though the school was technically bilingual, their teachers mostly spoke Spanish. In class, both girls' eyes glazed over. They looked lost. Sarah and Anna did their best to hide their discomfort in front of Irvy. "I try to say to myself that I'm not the only one and I should be calm about this," Anna told me, "because people have done it before and I'm pretty sure they've turned out fine. Plus," she said, "I will have a great college essay." But sometimes their anguish spilled out. They were used to excelling in school, and now they felt like they weren't learning anything. One night, when Sarah was struggling with homework, she lashed out at her parents, yelling exactly what Irvy had been afraid to hear, "I didn't choose to move here." She ran up to her room. Irvy stayed on the living room couch. They cried, separately. Outside those emotional swells, the family was relieved to be together, and free of the dread that had hung over them in New York. They relished the meals that Irvy's mother, Lulu, prepared for them, rich and tangy beef, chicken and vegetable stew, fluffy corn cakes piled with salsa and beans. With all of their children and grandchildren at home, she and Martine now felt that they could live out their lives in peace. Sarah and Anna told me they felt safer in Mexico. Rachel agreed, but worried about the friends and family they'd left behind. She thought they were too close to see what the United States was becoming. They felt lucky to have had the freedom to immigrate to Mexico. No relatives in the United States relied on their care, and the sale of the Bronx townhouse funded the move. But it was still unclear how they would support themselves now that they were here. Rachel tried to be patient as Irvy figured out a plan. He had worked for so many years in the United States without a break, and he was clearly depressed. He knew he had to sell his motorcycle. He spent all day on the farm streaming Hot 97, an English-language radio station in New York. At night, he would scroll the social media feed of the nightclub where he'd worked, telling Rachel which artists had performed and who had gotten into fights, until she snapped. "I don't care," she said, pleading with him to leave New York in the past. "I'm trying to be positive," Irvy told me, but he felt like a disappointment. He began to pull away from the girls. He seemed to miss the United States more as time went on, not less. In Oaxaca, another American family invited them over to celebrate their first Thanksgiving in Mexico. He took one bite of stuffing and burst into tears. But that same month, he saw on Instagram that ICE had raided his bodega hangout in the Bronx. One of his friends, a father who worked as a bike messenger for a Chinese restaurant, was taken away. Irvy tried to reconnect with his relatives by attending birthday and anniversary parties. "Half the town are his cousins," Rachel told me. He took me along to one party in a small house with a concrete floor. Plastic tables with bowls of taco fixings were set up in a long row that stretched from the kitchen into the living room. I sat with two of Irvy's aunts, Chela Santiago and Blanca Mendez, who are in their late 60s and have spent their whole lives in San Lorenzo Cacao Tepec. Their fathers traveled back and forth to the United States, first as braceros, then as unauthorized farmhands. Since then, dozens of relatives have followed. Chela's brother went to New York in the 1990s and slept 10 to a room. "What they say about the United States isn't true," he said when he returned. "They treat you like animals." "Without poor Mexicans," Blanca told me, "the U.S. would not exist." "I would like for all the Mexicans in the United States to come here," she said, "and then let's see what the United States really is." Though Irvy was only a few seats away, she offered another blunt assessment of those who choose to leave home. "Sometimes they go because they want a life that isn't theirs. Here, we live authentically." Irvy was quiet. The United States was where he'd become a man, a husband, a father, a homeowner, a model citizen in every respect except the one that mattered to the U.S. government. Now he had done what his aunt wanted, what President Trump wanted, and he was beginning to live with that choice. Surrounded by family, He looked like a man without a home. People who migrate across borders leave pieces of themselves behind, pieces that don't fit neatly back into place, even upon return. Irvi had known this since he was 19. A year after the family decided to leave the U.S., Rachel and the girls were discovering it, too. They went to New York to visit Rachel's parents this past Christmas. Right away, Sarah bought frosted strawberry Pop-Tarts to bring back to her classmates in Oaxaca. She giggled on the phone at night with her new Mexican boyfriend. But Rachel had to pry her and Anna away from playdates with their New York friends. She changed the subject when they asked about visiting again for spring break in a few months. They ate traditional Chinese food in one friend's home, Russian in another, Dominican in another, the kind of New York experience that they were all realizing they missed. During one visit in Harlem, Rachel asked to speak with me alone at a coffee shop nearby. When we sat together, she finally broke down. She felt guilty every time she heard her daughters say they were happy to be home for the holidays. She saw them falling behind their New York friends academically, so she bought an algebra book to teach them herself. Her old fear of ice was coursing through her body, even though Irvi was safe in Mexico. And she had been stifling these emotions around her parents all week because none of them wanted to be the first to cry. "We tried so hard to make it work," she told me. "I can't think of anything else we could have done. And that's the hardest thing about being here. We're nice people. My kids are amazing. New York City would have been so lucky to have my kids." She told me that a few days earlier, she had gone to visit an uncle in her old neighborhood in the Bronx, but avoided driving past the bright blue house. Cookie, their neighbor, had reported that another family moved in, but left within weeks. The house was dark and empty, the gardens were a mess, an old couch was outside, rotting. The Cruises had poured themselves into that house. Now it looked like they had never lived there. Rachel couldn't bear to see it. That concludes this week's reading from the Atlantic Magazine. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.